Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Rick Rosoff. Rick runs a very important service. He is the editor of the Stop NATO website. It provides vital information on the organization. You can call it anything you want. What I call a global killing machine. That's the best way to describe what NATO is. And NATO is on the march. NATO is expanding. Instead of being a North Atlantic alliance, it wants to be a global alliance. A global alliance against peace. What else? Rick, it's great to have you back on again. There's so much going on. I've been focusing heavily on Syria. You're covering that and lots of other issues. Let me let you jump into what's most on your mind today.
I want to tell you how pleasant it is to hear the opening strains from the string orchestra that is your theme music. Someday you'll tell me what it is.
it's a movement of a Haydn symphony.
Ah, okay. Well, Haydn's a good choice. The most prolific symphonist, I think, in history, is he not?
Oh, indeed. 104 that we know about.
Yeah.
Maybe there's another 104 that would come out. Oh, that would be lovely.
There was a statement by Georg Brandes, the famous Danish literary historian and critic, during World War I, where he talked about, he didn't mention Haydn, but he might well have added him, that, you know, with the several million, up to 10 million people who were killed in the, you know, primarily in the trenches in World War I, how many more Newtons, how many more Hegels, how many more Haydns, how many more Einsteins and so forth, you know, would the world have been blessed with that instead were killed, you know, at 18 or 19 years of age. And to place things in perspective, we're not only fighting for peace, against war, rather, we're fighting for what peace means, what demilitarization means. And it means, you know, attention to and higher valuation of, you know, what is truly human in our existence instead of, you know, the brutal and the self-interested and violent and appalling aspects of humanity that we all wish, I guess, centuries ago we could have put behind us. But having offered that as a lead-in, I think you had said something to me recently, and you certainly have documented it in your painstaking daily columns, that we're in a period of interlude of perhaps, I don't want to say false dawn, or lull before the storm, I think is how you phrased it. And I fear that's, you know, probably the best way to begin our conversation, is that we're in some sort of interim and we're waiting for, the next shoe or the next missile to drop.
Oh, indeed so. Well, there's no question, Rick, that America targets all independent countries for regime change. The issue isn't whether it's a democratic one or a despotic one, or, as I like to put it, anything in between. It's either a nation that's subservient to U.S. interests or one that maintains its sovereignty as something more important than bowing and scraping to America. And nations like Iraq under Saddam, a despotic state, Syria under Assad, you could call Syria an authoritarian state. It certainly is not a despotic state, and it certainly has changed over the past couple of years. And I've written about their new constitution, their new parliamentary elections, the first democratic ones in the country's history. I mean, literally, they put to shame with what passes for elections in America, and they were absolutely met with derision, including the constitution that went to a national referendum. America's constitution
right.
Didn't go to a national referendum. Rich white guys decided what the Constitution would be, and they wrote it for themselves, Rick. They didn't give a damn about ordinary people. In fact, back then, only 15% of the population could vote.
Right, right. And whose statement is it that the country is best governed by those who own it?
Oh, indeed.
That's one of the founding fathers, isn't it?
John Jay, first Supreme Court Justice. And John Adams, second president, said America should be run by, quote, the rich and the well-born.
Dear Lord, what a revealing comment that is. Thanks for sharing that with us.
And we call this democracy, Rick.
Yes, it's amazing, the everything but the truth. There's a line by Oscar Wilde that says, mankind is always willing to believe the impossible, but rarely the improbable. And I don't think he was being intentionally provocative or ironical there. I think he really meant that, and I think there's an element of truth there. In terms of what's gone on in the last week, we know of the law in the immediate situation, of course, in and surrounding Syria. And we know that a diplomatic coup de main, if you will, by Russia calling the U.S.'s bluff, essentially, is how I interpret it, seems to have led to the postponement. And certainly not, I don't think we can say at this point, the elimination of a threat of a U.S. and allied military attack against Syria. And, you know, as you've documented in your articles, an attack against Syria is not just that, but it's the opening salvo in what will be a regional conflagration, and will, as inevitably as anything, drag neighboring nations like Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Israel, nearby nations like Iran and others, you know, into the vortex, Russia too, inevitably. So that the U.S., both in the presence, of its head of state, Barack Obama, and his Secretary of State, John Kerry, and his Defense Chief Chuck Hagel, but also, you know, what is supposedly the other side of the aisle, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Stephen, there's so precious a little difference between the two political parties. It's almost two compartments of the, you know, the same office. But that, you know, the John McCains of the world being out of the White House, the Republicans are, you know, even more provocative and reckless and saber-rattling, you know, in their demands. You know, most recently we've seen John McCain's guest editorial in Pravda, which is a, you know, blistering attack against the Russian government, the head of state, the political system. And even though claiming not to be a Russophobe, he certainly demonstrated that he was precisely that. This is, again, you know, with all its flaws in their legion, with all the flaws in the Russian political and particularly the electoral system, they have, you know, far more political parties in parliament. Members of those political parties, in many cases, occupy key positions and on committees and so forth within both houses, the upper and lower of the Russian parliament. The range of political difference, manifested or exhibited by those political parties is something we could never dream of here. Where, you know, air can barely creep between, the minor crevice that separates Democrats and Republicans, particularly in foreign policy. But we also have to note, I think, that's something that's important. You may have reflected on this yourself in your columns, but the recently concluded summit, the Heads of State Summit, of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Kyrgyzstan issued a statement that was very strongly condemnatory of any plans for outside military intervention in Syria. And this, of course, is an organization who, with its full members, its observers, and its dialogue partners, takes in over half of the human race. I mean, in those various categories, we're thinking about China and India and the two most populous nations in the world. We also have a statement by Syrian head of state Bashar al-Assad a few days ago in relation to the Russian intervention and the seeming U.S., at least temporary, climb down around the issue of direct military intervention, where he said words to the effect, this is a paraphrase of his comments by Russian press agency Novosti, that what has happened with the Syrian resolve, the Russian intervention with Chinese and Iranian support, is that what we may be seeing is the emergence of a new balance of world power. And I think that's a critical statement that needs to be digested properly.
Well, I think that's very important, Rick. Russia really performed heroic services. What else can you call it? Vladimir Putin, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, the Deputy Foreign Ministers, various officials. They really went to the wall to get together with John Kerry in Geneva last weekend to craft an agreement. And it must have been like pulling teeth for these guys. But they came up with something that Russia was agreeable about, because Russia and China three times, as you know, Rick, vetoed Western Security Council resolutions that really were an authorization to go to war against Syria, and Russia absolutely will do everything possible to prevent this. And there's nothing in the Geneva Agreement that permits doing it under the UN Charter's Chapter 7, which is the way they get around this kind of stuff. And the way they did it against Libya, I forget if they used Chapter 7 language, they may have done that, but the phrase "all necessary measures" was included in the resolution, and "all necessary measures" was literally an open sesame to start bombing, and that's when NATO got involved in the campaign. But so far, the war on Syria is on hold. I honestly think it's going to come. The pretext is so easy to create, Rick, as you know, and the attack on the suburban Damascus suburb called Ghouta, where nobody really knows how many people were killed. John Kerry came up with an absurd number of 1,429. I think on one of my earlier programs, and maybe in one or more of my articles, I said, did he go there and count them? 1,429. He could have said over 1,000, 1,400. Well, France and Britain disagreed with him, and between the two of them, they mentioned something between 200 or 300 or so. And independent reports suggest that maybe scores were killed. No one's really 100% sure what it was, but the so-called UN inspectors was a setup group. It was a rigged commission to point fingers the wrong way at Syria without indicting them for something they absolutely didn't do. The rogue insurgents were responsible for this, and there's an awful lot of evidence to show that they did do it. But so far, Russia is like King Canute, Rick, literally holding back the tsunami of an impending war.
You put that wonderfully. That's a wonderful image. It truly is. I think, you know, the world had been supremely disappointed in Russian lack of resolve vis-a-vis Yugoslavia in 1999, Iraq in 2003, Libya, as you alluded to, 2.5 years ago. And that, you know, apparently, you know, Obama can rant and, you know, discourse mindlessly about red lines. But to use, I guess, an appropriate metaphor, given the part of the world we're talking about, Russia has drawn a line in the sand and does not appear prepared to back down. We also know that Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, and particularly Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, have been involved in presenting to the UN Security Council evidence that, in fact, the attack in the Damascus suburb was perpetrated by U.S. and allied-backed terrorists, both, you know, external and internal by nature, that is both foreign and domestic, I think increasingly more foreign. Incidentally, you're privy, and maybe many of your listeners are, as I am, to United Nations released figures about the alleged 100,000 people killed in Syria, where some 45% of them are supposedly, reportedly, Syrian military and internal security personnel. Ooh. And that, you know, and then of the civilian population, we can only surmise what percentage have been killed by the U.S.-backed terrorist elements, so that even by, you know, U.N.-approved, if not issued, figures, it's clear that a majority of the people killed in Syria have been killed by, the sort of rogue brigands and cannibals and beheaders that are supported by the likes of John McCain.
Rick, a couple of days ago, you know about the interview that President Assad gave to Fox News. Mm-hmm. Very odd that he would give an interview to Fox News. He was in Damascus, and former Congressman Dennis Kucinich is now a Fox commentator. He was one of the two Fox people who were in Damascus and interviewed him. But he said, and I quoted him from his interview, that he believes that something on the order of 80 to 90% of the insurgents fighting against his government are extremists, jihadists, al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, and other extremist groups. And he mentioned the number 15,000 as he was asked point blank how many Syrian soldiers have been killed, and he used the number 15,000. Now, I don't know what the number is, but there's a divergence between what the UN is saying and what Assad himself told Fox News.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, thanks for that. You know, the combination of soldiers and, militia members, police officers and so forth, could well get to the figure we're talking about of 45,000, I suppose, you know, in conjunction with the number that President Assad gave. We've seen comparable reports from other, including U.S. Press agencies, by the way, that, experts are estimating, majority of the so-called rebels are indeed extremist elements, religious extremist elements, from bad to worse, from bad to worse to unthinkable, almost. And that what the U.S. is doing, as a matter of fact, just today on Novosti, the Russian Federal Security Bureau, their the former KGB, as the Western press never fails to remind us, in relation to one of its former employees, Vladimir Putin, estimates that some 300 to 400 Russian nationals are fighting as mercenaries with rebel forces in Syria, and that Russia, again, this is, an issue that was raised by the Russian government, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, in the first instance, are extremely concerned that these people are being given combat experience, being integrated into not only a regional but a global terrorist network, work, you know, courtesy of the United States, its NATO allies, and their allies in the Persian Gulf, you know, the eminently non-democratic hereditary despots in the Gulf Cooperation Council, but that they're continuing to build up an international network of extremists that can be deployed from country to country. And this is something, of course, that emanates from Afghanistan starting in the late 70s, you know, as early as 1978 or 79, where the Jimmy Carter Zbigniew Brzezinski regime, let's use the word they use for others, no? It's far more applicable here than many of the other countries that are stigmatized with that label. But that, you know, bringing extremists or creating extremists, training them in common camps, giving them an international flavor, integrating their, you know, military units and so forth for deployment back home and to third countries afterwards, is a process the United States and its allies has been actively engaged in for, you know, 40 years. And we have to realize that they go from one terrorist triumph to the other, you know, from, you know, say, Kosovo to Libya to Iraq to Syria and back again, while, you know, claiming still to be waging a so-called global war on terror, even if the Obama administration has euphemized that under the, you know, the expression overseas contingency operations. But, you know, in terms of building an international network, Steve, before I forget, the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, was in London yesterday and the day preceding, I believe, or yesterday for sure, the 19th, and he was quoted by the Daily Telegraph and other sources saying that NATO has not ruled out military strikes against Syria and so forth. And he gave a an address at the Carnegie Europe Center, and he made some statements I think are really very revealing, because it talks about another sort of international network, one that's built in conjunction with this you know, extremist network that NATO is supporting with its air force in places like Libya and Kosovo earlier. He said yesterday, NATO remains vigilant. We continue to keep the situation in Syria under close review, and we continue to protect the alliance's southeastern border. We've talked about that before. And then he says the following, and it's a clear echo. You know, this parrot is repeating what his master has told him. This is right out of Obama's speech a couple Tuesday nights ago. And I quote Rasmussen again: "I have no doubt that the recent agreement with Syria and Russia could not have been reached without a credible military option." In other words, we hadn't blackmailed them militarily, you know, Russian and Syria would not have got into line. He then goes on, however, to talk about the new post-Afghanistan NATO. And he talks about NATO sending troops to Afghanistan and Kosovo, I'm quoting him, in the Mediterranean and off the Horn of Africa, over the Baltic states and near Turkey's border. Elsewhere, he talks about deploying forces on NATO operations in Afghanistan, Kosovo, the Mediterranean, the Indian Ocean. And then he finishes with this one. NATO is looking into a request to provide you know, assistance to the Libyan new Libyan armed forces. And Rasmussen ends his speech pretty much with this: "I would also like to see NATO further develop cooperative relations with regional organizations such as the Arab League, the Gulf Cooperation Council, and the African Union." You know, you're talking about 70 nations. Roughly, there's some overlapping between the GCC and the Arab League and the African Union, but that he is talking about extending military partnerships to another 70 nations. There are already some 80 members and partners of NATO. This would mean something like 150 nations in which the U.S.-dominated military bloc has, you know, sunk its tentacles. This is unprecedented. I mean, it's grandiose, and we'll see his ability to deliver on these desiderata. But, you know, nevertheless, this is how grandiose and global they truly are in their aspirations.
Oh, it really is, Rick. I just pulled up. I knew about Rasmussen's comments, and I just double-checked. I was going to ask you to send me a link to what you have, but I just pulled up something that's dated September 19th. Rasmussen is giving an address. It's titled NATO, Ready, Robust, Rebalanced. It's got a lot of comments and I'm going to go through it, but in another article I'll write about Syria maybe today, I have to quote from what you just said to indicate that despite what Rasmussen said from months earlier during the Syrian conflict, that NATO had no intention of getting involved in it, and we know that's a bald-faced lie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Turkey already is involved. And Washington's involved, and Britain's involved, and France is involved. So there's four NATO countries, and Israel as a Mediterranean, what's the term, Mediterranean Alliance?
Mediterranean Dialogue Partner. It is the first member of the Mediterranean Dialogue, incidentally, to be given what's called an individual cooperation program partnership in 2006, with the others following. By the way, Libya is being groomed for incorporation into the Mediterranean Dialogue, as I'm sure in Brussels and in Washington and at the Pentagon, Syria and Lebanon. You know, well, post-regime change.
Oh, despicable. I wanted to make a comment about Israel. It's been in less than the past year. I mean, Israel is literally part of Washington's war on Syria, and there's no question that it's Washington's war on Syria with a close alliance with France and Britain and Turkey and the rogue Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan's involved because it's harboring U.S. troops and the jihadists on the border. And Israel, in less than the past year, has staged bombing raids against Syria four times. It's
That's
made
right.
cross-border incursions. It's shell cross border, and so far Syria has held its fire. It has not responded, and each of the Israeli acts was an act of aggression. And what does the world do, Rick? It yawns and does nothing.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. That's exactly it. And at the same time, I mean, to understand partially why that is, there were reports here, you know, about a week and a half ago, or a week immediately before the Obama speech and really before the Russian intervention, that the American-Israeli Public Action Committee, is that it? Committee rather than Council,
yep.
APEC,
yep.
Was deploying 300-some-odd lobbyists
yes.
to Capitol Hill to make sure that particularly any congressman and all 435 are up for re-election next year, that any of them that may have any inclination, any predisposition to vote their conscience and that of, you know, some 80 or 90% of their constituents were told how politics really works in Washington, and that if they dared go against APEC diktat on this issue, then they had better find a new career.
Oh, it's
which
true,
is the only way of interpreting that. And that, you know, this kind of heavy-handed pressure coming down where it's, you know, you don't dare defy that lobby, of course, on foreign policy issues or anything, you know, particularly pertaining to the Middle East. And that, you know, in a way, congressmen were spared the humiliation of either capitulating to APEC pressure and having to go back and explain to their constituents or being voted out of office next year by their constituents rather than, you know, having a multi-million dollar campaign waged against them with APEC support by the Russian intervention.
Oh,
so, you know, we were spared another humiliating specimen of how the legislative branch of the American political system, in fact, functions.
Well, it's very, very true. And, I mean, I wrote about how APEC has deployed a brigade, you call it what you want. I mean, scores of lobbyists in Washington going up, literally lobbying Senate members, House members, and that's where APEC concentrates, mostly on Capitol Hill. But it has the administrations, all administrations, Republicans and Democrats, in its back pocket. And literally, I've quoted Edward Said, the late Edward Said. Oh, I wish we still had him around. He'd be a marvelous guest on this program. He's been gone for, oh, 6-7 years now. Maybe it's even longer than that. But he once said that APEC or the Israeli lobby, I forget if he said APEC or the Israeli lobby in general. There are 51 Zionist organizations. APEC is the best known one. The Zionist Organization of America is the oldest one, going back well over a century. And the Anti-Defamation League is about a century old this year. But Said said that within a matter of hours, the lobby can marshal virtually the entire Senate to come together and support whatever Israel wants on virtually anything. I mean, that's how powerful the lobby is. And it really is a disgrace, Rick, because APEC is a foreign agent. Legally, it's a foreign agent. It operates illegally because it is not licensed as a foreign agent. And who does anything
about
it?
It's not licensed as a political action committee. I mean, the most powerful lobbying group in the United States is not, you know, under the constraints of what, any tiny PAC would be,
yes.
because it's not technically a political action committee. It doesn't directly dispense monies.
It just twists the rules, and nobody really cares one way or another. I've written about this, but I forget exactly how they did it many years ago. They had a different name going way, way back to the 1950s or so, around that time frame, and they changed their name and became became APEC, and literally they have operated extrajudiciously, but nobody does anything about it. And when they have their national convention every year, all the key movers and shakers in Washington show up almost every every year. I think Obama didn't this past year, but he's been there several times, and many members of Congress, many other important people show up to salam to AIPAC's belligerent, hostile agenda, which includes waging war on countries like Syria and Iran. And Iran is the prime target, as we know, Rick. Syria is merely a way station. I call it a sideshow on the road to Tehran. And it's an expression I like to use all the time, and others have used it as well, is saying the road to Tehran runs through Damascus. The idea is you get rid of the Assad government, you isolate Iran, and then you target the Iranian government full force. And again, the same idea, regime change by any method, including war.
No, right you are on that. And what we're talking about is, of course, you know, with the hypothetical displacement of the replacement of the government in Damascus, we're talking about both Iran and Russia losing its last foothold in the entire Arab world. We are talking about not only Russia losing its, you know, docking and refueling facility at the Tartus naval base in the Mediterranean and, you know, in Syria. We're talking about Russia, effectively, of the 22, you know, nations, member states, rather, the Arab League, having no firm ally, you know, politically, economically, certainly not militarily, and the same with Iran. But we're, you know, the road to Tehran runs through Damascus, but so do the roads to Moscow and Beijing. And we should be clear about this because the Chinese and the Russians are. And I think we may have talked about this before, Stephen, but if you want an historical parallel, I would cite Spain in the mid-1930s. Where you had fascist Italy, Mussolini, and Nazi Germany, Hitler, you know, supporting the insurgents who crossed over from a neighboring country, if you recall, Morocco, invaded Spain, attempted to topple a secular Republican government. You had nations like Mexico and the Soviet Union supporting the legal government, the Spanish Republic. You had the two emerging fascist powers in Europe using Spain as a battleground in which to test out their military, their infantry and their air forces in the case of Germany. And that, you know, nothing less than that, I concur with you, is occurring in and in relation to Syria right now. Syria is the Spain of the 21st century. And if Germany had had its nose bloodied good in 1937 or 1938, they would have not gone on to invade Poland and launch the deadliest war in America's history, and the same with Mussolini's Italy. And if Russia and China and Iran and Syria in the first place are able to stop this drive to war against Syria, we may very well see a new balance of world power, as Assad alluded to the other day.
Oh, Rick, I think you made some very, very important points, and I've also made the points in my articles that the final battleground is America challenging China and Russia, and if you take away all the independent states, then they alone remain, and at some point they have to draw a red line and say no more. I hope Russia has drawn that red line. China may be doing it a little bit more quietly. It has very strong economic ties to America, of course, and the idea that the analogy of Spain in the 1930s, it's been a good while, several years, but I've written about the Spanish Civil War, and the only reason General Franco, of course.
Yeah.
The only reason he prevailed is because he got enormous aid, mainly from Hitler and also Mussolini, and Roosevelt did virtually nothing to help the other side. If they had the equivalent amount of aid from Western countries, they could have defeated fascism right then and there, but they didn't get it, and they fought a valiant fight, and they also had internal disputes among themselves, so they helped defeat themselves at the same time. But they lost, and of course the first infamous terror bombing took place, the notorious Guernica bombing, where Hitler practiced what he would do across Europe with the London bombings and the rest of it. But all of these things never should have been World War II. Hitler never should have come to power. He never should have come to power in the first place. But the bankers wanted him, and we're just about on end of time, Rick. I don't have any more time to go on, but a quick final comment.
Well, I just, you know, appreciate once again the opportunity. This is both a very sympathetic and friendly forum, but it's also simultaneously, you know, very stimulating and thought-provoking one. So this is, you know, I would do these shows every day if you would indulge me.
Oh, indeed. I mean, we could keep this up all day. There's no question about that. And every time a program ends, I say, oh, I wish I had another half an hour, another 2 hours.
Yeah, me too.
There's always so much else to talk about. Rick, it really is wonderful having you on. I look forward to having you come back. back. You'll watch things closely. So will I. I write about them every day. You're following them daily on the Stop NATO website. I encourage listeners to follow Stop NATO every single day for important new pieces of information that Rick posts, vital information on NATO-related interests, vital stuff to know what's going on. Rick, again, my great thanks.
Yeah, thank you in return.
And join us Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.